Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, how are you?
Freezing. It was like 65 and now it's 25.
Your icicles got icicles.
Yeah, my poor hands were really cold when I came into the studio this evening. So it's been that roller coaster. I'm glad we did not get the tornadoes that a lot of the country got, though. It's looking pretty grim out there.
Yeah, some violent weather. You know, I didn't even care that I couldn't go riding in the warm weather. It was nice to just not have the bully stuffing you in your locker for a couple of days.
Oh, I guess that answers my next question.
What's that?
I thought you were like out sailing on your bike because everybody was complaining about the wind. I thought, well, you'll just keep going. You didn't ride then.
I didn't have an opportunity because of a lot of factors, you know, the weather, the wind and the rain being one of them. But
yeah,
life intervened.
Life intervened. But you have ridden in the month of January.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh,
I know a lot of people want to ride every single month.
Yeah.
You know, that's the... Hallmark.
Well, you know, it's not that much of a badge of honor here in Northeast Ohio anymore. Our winters have subsided. So it's like, almost anybody can do it.
Almost.
It ain't hard as it used to be.
I'm not going to touch that one. Hey, last week's show had so much feedback, more than any I can remember since we went on the air in 2010.
Huh.
It seems that Inga Thompson's interview just struck a chord with a whole lot of people. They fell in love with her. I certainly enjoyed the time we got to spend chatting. I hope she finds a comfortable niche for herself back in the sport. And that's what a lot of people are saying. Maybe women are going to be the answer to fixing some of the things in sport. It would be nice if they fixed some of the other things in the world, too. The news on the way over here tonight was so grim, listening to all these people who are fleeing Syria. And it's just horrible out there. It's horrible. You know, I guess I'm just too much of a socialist. Hey, can we take a couple minutes and pitch Radiothon?
We certainly should, because it starts in a week.
I know. It seems like it was not a year ago, but I guess it's been a year ago. So we only come to you once a year to help us raise money for operating expenses for the station, WJCU. Greg and I, we're all volunteers. It's nonprofit. All the money that we raise during Radiothon is earmarked for the station, right?
Exactly. Yep.
It doesn't go anywhere else in the college.
And not only that, it doesn't go to pay anybody's salary at the station.
It's because none of us get paid.
There are a couple of people who are on the university payroll
that
work here, but it all goes back into programming in terms of equipment, services. You know, we have a live web stream. We host the podcasts. Those are not provided by volunteers, as it were.
Well, and Greg and I are sitting in a studio that was paid for by Radiothon last year, and it's beautiful. It's brand new. It's had its little ups and downs and quirks, but it is really state of the art, and it's a very nice space to be in to bring you this show every single week. Your donation is tax deductible.
It is.
We are a 501c3, I think is what it's called. Radiothon will begin next Saturday, probably early in the morning, right, with the first show of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It will continue through the following Sunday.
Sunday.
We actually get to be here for two Saturdays and ask you to please pull out your credit card or write a check in your checkbook to Radiothon for WJCU. And Greg and I will be here February 9th and 16th. And we promise we'll deliver you another great year of The Outspoken Cyclist.
Can't ask for more than that. It's listener-supported radio. We do get a little bit of funding from John Carroll University, but that really doesn't cover anywhere close to what it takes to keep a radio station on the air. And so we're very proud of the fact that so many of our listeners enjoy the programming here enough to turn that into a tangible expression in the form of a donation once a year during Radiothon. So we hope that you'll be generous in the next couple of weeks, and we'll have details for you as far as phone numbers. There's an online pledge form that you can fill out. We'll try and have that information for you. Well, we will have that information for you coming up next Saturday.
And we can put it up on Facebook, too,
mm-hmm.
and on the Outspoken Cyclist blog. So we will make sure that you'll be able to find it anywhere you look or listen. So we're going to move on. Cycling is showcasing its finest riders in Louisville right now. I was told today that it was like riding through chocolate pudding. It has been cold, and then it's been warm, and then it's been rainy, and then it's been snowy. It's just a mess. Earlier this week was when the Masters ran, and I saw pictures on Facebook of bikes that went a half a lap and looked like they'd been out in like a mud storm for weeks on end. I would hate to be the one having to clean the bikes. It was just be like, ugh.
Isn't that optimal cyclocross conditions?
It is, allegedly. But I mean, if your wheels won't turn and your pedals won't turn, it gets pretty ugly. Pretty ugly. Let's move on to the show for this week. We are leaving cyclocross, Lance, Oprah, the UCI behind this week. We're going to look forward to the upcoming bike summit, the start of the cycling season for us living in colder climates. I know people are already out there riding. And in the weeks leading up to the League of American Bicyclists bike summit, which is March 4th through 6th this year, I always like to check in with one of the people who I think is the most savviest, if that's a word, in D.C., in addition to being the president of Rails to Trails Conservancy, Keith Laughlin has lived and worked in Washington, D.C. since 1979. Even though he, quote unquote, left government many years ago, he's kept himself apprised of what is going on with all aspects of his interests, including transportation. I'm always impressed with his commentary on a wide variety of legislative initiatives, and I'm sure that our conversation is going to be enlightening this evening. Keith will be with us in a few moments, and then we are going to be speaking with two distinguished PhDs in the fields of urban planning and urban affairs. John Pucker is a professor in the Department of Urban Planning at the Blaustein School of Planning and Policy at Rutgers University. Ralph Bueller is assistant professor in the Department of Urban Affairs and Planning in the School of Public and International Affairs at Virginia Tech. They've edited a new book from MIT Press titled City Cycling. Covers a wide range of topics from cycling safety, infrastructure, including bikeways and bike parking, a wide range of bike designs and bike equipment, integration of cycling with public transportation, and promoting cycling, especially for women and children. They believe that bicycling in cities is booming. The book not only tells us why, but offers guidelines on how to make it boom where you live and work. So thanks for being with us tonight. Let's welcome Keith Laughlin back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Well, thank you, Diane. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. I was going to begin our conversation a little differently and wrap up 2012, but there was some unsettling news this week, and I know you have some thoughts about it. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood has tendered his resignation. What do you think?
Well, this is definitely disappointing because he's been the biggest champion for trails, cycling and walking that we've had at the U.S. Department of Transportation. So that's really a loss. But we have to, do our best to make sure that the next secretary that replaces him shares that enthusiasm for cycling. And we have been mobilizing some of our supporters. And just within the last 24 hours, we generated 5,000 emails to the White House asking the president to appoint someone to this position who shares Secretary LaHood's dedication to cycling.
Do you know anybody who might be on the short list?
Well, you keep hearing all of these names, and it's really hard to tell if they're real or not. I mean, the one we probably hear the most is Mayor Villagrosa of Los Angeles, and he is someone who has, over the last few years, become someone who's really been trying to promote cycling in Los Angeles, which has not always been a great, bicycle-friendly place. And so his name's been on the list. Congressman Oberstar is usually mentioned at some point. And then I even saw Governor Granholm of Michigan, former Governor Granholm, recently mentioned. And she would also be great. She was great when she was governor of Michigan.
Well, and that's your home state.
Yes, that's my home state.
Yeah, go Michigan.
Yeah.
Occasionally, cabinet positions don't get filled in a timely manner. Like very often. Is it possible that we could be without a transportation secretary for a while?
No, I don't think so. And
okay.
when he announced his resignation, he said he would stay on until his successor was approved by the Senate.
Okay.
And so he's on until the new guy comes on board.
Well, that's a good thing then.
Yes.
And we hope that whoever the new secretary is will, in fact, be in favor of walking and biking programs. So one of the issues that comes up when we talk about more bicycle and pedestrian-friendly programs is that of the environment. And I didn't realize this, but you're on the board of the Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. I'm not sure what that is exactly, but do the programs that the organization promotes, endorse, and support include transportation programs?
Yes, the organization is a grassroots program in inner city Detroit trying to, you know, the primary purposes of the group are to try to reduce the toxic exposure in the neighborhoods of the inner city, but in addition to create more sustainable community in Detroit. And a part of that has to do with land use planning and transportation planning and, you know, increasing opportunities to walk and bike. You know, in the Motor City, which is, you know, a place that, you know, traditionally has been very car dominated.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're talking Detroit. But I remember reporting last fall on sort of a corridor that is being turned into a place to bike and walk that maybe next to a highway or something that connects two neighborhoods is what I kind of remember.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there, and we've been working for the last 10 years with the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan, which has been invested probably over $25 million in trail development in that area. So there are many corridors that have been under development. And so, and the one that's got a lot of notice has been the DeQuinder Cut, which is a rail trail right in the center of Detroit, an abandoned rail corridor. So we had been part of that project many, many years ago. So there's a lot happening there.
Which is good. They're not too far from us.
Right.
You know, we're only 3 hours from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
where we are. So mm-hmm. cycling and pedestrian programs lost a lot of ground in Congress in 2012. Recently, well, in fact, this week, the Governor Kasich here in Ohio is boasting a $1 billion surplus, but I can't believe he's going to actually earmark any of that money for transportation dollars. What do you think other states are doing? Are people experiencing surpluses, and will some of that money go to cycling and walking and not cars and roads?
Well, we have seen other states who are having surpluses just recently, and this is just because the economy is now coming back and tax revenues are increasing and the costs, you know, like unemployment are going down. So they're now having surpluses. I think part of it depends on how the state decides to, you know, to fund its transportation, because that has traditionally been done through the gas tax. And just because the surpluses are created doesn't mean it's actually more gas tax revenues are coming in to the state, and it depends on whether people are actually driving more than they were, that's what generates the gas tax revenue for this purpose. And so I think it depends if there's enough consensus in the state on transportation that they actually want to use general revenue funds from that surplus to use on transportation. And I think that's a state-by-state basis. I think it's very possible that it could happen in some places.
Well, I hope it happens here, because $1 billion is a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah, really. There's been so much animosity and so much nonpartisanship in D.C. Do you think we're going to see more gridlock, or is there a kind of a tiny chink in the armor right now?
Well, I think there's some opportunities. I think the bill that passed last year was not great for us. It was a 30% cut, but it also meant that this issue doesn't come up again specifically. It doesn't expire until September of 2014. So hopefully we'll have the Congress doing very little on this until, you know, sometime next year. And by then I hope maybe we will have a little bit more bipartisan support. There is one piece of good news there, and that is that last year our biggest supporter on the Transportation Committee in the House was Congressman Petri, who's a Republican from Wisconsin. And he had previously been denied a chairmanship of a subcommittee because he was too supportive of things like walking and biking and transit and not just highways. And the Republicans just reorganized the Transportation Committee, and he now chairs the subcommittee that has walking and biking under its jurisdiction. So the Subcommittee on Transportation in the Republican House of Representatives is now chaired by one of our best friends.
That's very cool. When did that happen? Just this week?
Yeah, it was within the last 2 weeks.
Nice. So let's talk about Rails to Trails a little bit, since that's your bailiwick.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to keep your programs viable?
Well, I think a big part of what we're doing is trying to adapt to the bill that just passed, because, as I said, it's about a 30% cut. And so we're just trying to make sure that we minimize the impact of that on trail building projects around the country. One thing we're doing there is that we've been running a clearinghouse for the U.S. Department of Transportation since the early 90s that tracks all the money from the Transportation Enhancements Program. But this new bill revised that program, and we now have a new program called the Alternative Transportation, Transportation Alternatives, actually, program. And so they've done enough reconfiguring of the program that we're spending a lot of our time with a website and with outreach to communities for them to understand how they now can access this new source of funding. It's not a new source of funding, but it's been reconfigured and it's different. We want to make sure that there's no confusion caused by these changes that result in projects not getting funded.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Keith Laughlin. He's the president of Rails to Trails Conservancy and has been in Washington a long time. Is membership of Rails to Trails still expanding? Do you see another big year for the organization?
Yes, we continue to grow every year. We're now over 150,000 members and supporters, and we had a very good year. This past year, we had on our Trail Finder website, we had over 3.5 million people visited our website looking for safe places to bike. And so we just see the demand for what we're doing just growing year by year. And so we're doing our best to meet that demand.
Are you rolling out any new programs this year?
I think this year the biggest thing I guess we're doing is on that Trail Finder website is we're coming out with a mobile app. And so that'll be out sometime early summer, I think. And
that's a
pretty big deal. This will help people, when they're out on your bike, being able to actually navigate and find the trails while you're out, not away from your desktop.
That's pretty cool.
Yes.
With all the negative publicity that's been going on about the competitive side of cycling, do you think it's going to have any impact on the legislative side? I mean, because, the government is actually sort of involved in a lot of this negative stuff that's going on with Lance Armstrong, for example.
I really don't think so. I think when members of Congress and senators think about this, I think what influences them is what they see back in their district, in their state, when they see lots of people out riding their bikes in their communities and when they hear from their citizens saying that these things are important. I think that is what really influences their decisions. And I think that, and I've always thought the same was true. I never thought that, Lance Armstrong winning all those Tour de France's was actually building support for building bike facilities here. So I didn't see it as much of a positive then, and so I really don't see it as much of a negative now.
So the Bike Summit is coming up in about a month,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what the asks will be this year, but do you think that grassroots organizations are still the places that are going to have a bigger impact on larger issues? Is that where it needs to start, is at home?
Oh, that's absolutely right, and there's no doubt about it. I don't think that any of the Washington groups working on these issues can be at all successful if we're not working, hand in glove with our partner grassroots organizations, because that's how we are politically effective. That's where we get clout. That's how we convince people that these programs are important. And so for us, it's all about that, creating those partnerships with those local advocacy groups.
Well, once again, you are always filled with such good information and such positive thinking. I look forward to seeing you in Washington next month. We'll get together and say hello again. And thank you so much for talking with us on the show this evening.
Well, thank you, Diane. It's my pleasure.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Mm-hmm, bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Keith Laughlin is the executive director of the Rails to Trails Conservancy, and he joined us from Washington, D.C.
He did indeed.
He's a very plugged-in kind of guy.
A very plugged-in kind of guy, and always has interesting and insightful things to say. I like talking with him. First of all, he's very on point. You know, you ask him a question, you get a good answer.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, he deals with a lot of high-level people, so he has to, you know, make his point in an economical manner.
Oh, he has been way high up. Yeah. Way high up. Yes, indeed.
So let's jump into the news here. I think we're going to have to take a break in the middle, but let's see what we can accomplish before the top of the hour.
Okay. Well, the first piece of news is not necessarily a good piece of news. Three-time Tour de France champion suffers compression fracture. Triple Tour de France winner Greg LeMond is recovering in hospital after a car accident close to his home in Minnesota. The American former pro crashed en route to a dental appointment in nearby Wayzata and injured his back. He has no memory of the crash. Quote, we don't really know what happened, but there were about 400 accidents here this weekend. The roads have been terrible due to icy conditions, his wife Kathy LeMond told Velo Nation today. The 51-year-old is being treated in a local hospital, but is expected to be released later this week. He suffered a compression fracture in his back. He will be in a brace for 3 months and is expected to make a full recovery. And so we wish him well. Speedy recovery, Mr. LeMond. This one is no surprise, but remember talking with Mary McConnellou and her husband, Mike Broderick, and they were getting ready to do the Trans Andes Challenge again?
Mm-hmm.
Well, today we can report that they once again crushed their competition, finishing the 6-day stage race in 21 hours, 21 minutes, and 1 second. The next closest team in their mixed open category was from Brazil. They came in at 28 hours, 27 minutes, 26 seconds. Way to go. So,
wow.
Yeah, they really, really did well. Really did well. Not surprising. This one I thought was pretty strange. It comes from Bicycle Retail and Industry News. So they take teams of people and send them to different cities to go and find out about bike shops in the cities and nice places to ride and that kind of thing. So this week, their team of reporters were in San Francisco, and on a stop to the Wax Museum at Fisherman's Wharf, they spotted a cart that had the torso of Lance Armstrong on one shelf and his head and hands on another. Beyonce replaced Lance. So they were taking down Lance and putting up Beyonce.
Oh.
Wait, a day later, they stopped back to the museum. Beyonce had been replaced by Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm not sure what's going on, but Lance is evidently in meltdown, as they would say in the museum. They took him out. So that was kind of interesting, I thought. And this one's from Huffington Post. It was online. It seems that highly ranked politicians are not permitted to commute by bike to their Washington, D.C. jobs. From Mark Blumenthal on January 29th, President Obama may have gained a new chief of staff, but Washington has apparently lost what would have been its most powerful bike commuter. In announcing the appointment of Dennis McDonough as White House Chief of Staff on Friday, Obama addressed McDonough's children about the added demands of their father's new job. Quote, Dad will probably have to stop riding his bike to work, Obama joked. As Chief of Staff, I don't think that's allowed. According to a Bloomberg News report in early January, McDonough had already given up his bike commute. His preferred mode of transport to work was a bicycle until his wife forbade him from biking D.C. streets after an accident. He was not the only D.C. commuter to find the demands of a high-profile job conflicted with commuting by bicycle. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu told the New York Times in 2009 that he, too, was a bike commuter until his security detail overruled it. Quote, my security detail didn't want me to be riding my bicycle or even taking the metro, Chu said. I have a security detail that drives me where I need to go. So I thought that was kind of an interesting piece, I guess.
Can't get away from those helicopter parents even when you're a grown adult. Jeez Louise.
I know. What can I tell you? So that's the story. There was an excellent article in the Wall Street Journal this week written by Jason Gay. It was about the cyclocross championships that are going on in Louisville this weekend. And his characterizations of the riders, the spectators, and the sport are really spot on and fun. The article was titled "The Other and Parenthetically Cooler Super Bowl." I thought that was a great headline. Here's a really short excerpt to get you a feel for it. Quote, "The sport is booming at the grassroots amateur level. There are races throughout the country and a season that stretches from late summer into midwinter. And while the racers are competitive, cyclocross is also beloved for its laid-back atmosphere and sense of humor, because taking yourself too seriously is for road racers." It goes on to say, Joan Hanscom, the organizer of the Louisville event, the Worlds they're talking about, recalled a recent cyclocross race in which a fan in a unicorn costume dangled cookies from a fishing line on the course for passing riders to grab. Tim Johnson, a three-time U.S. National Men's Elite Champion, remembered a race in which spectators tempted riders with dollar bills in beer cans. And Power said he's seen strips of bacon on a fishing line. He's also wheeled around corners in the woods and encountered naked people. So if you want to read more of the article, it's really good. It's from the Wall Street Journal online, and it was the other cooler Super Bowl, and it was on January 30th.
Super Bowl's coming up.
Tomorrow.
No. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Right.
That would be tomorrow.
See, I'm already working on ignoring it, and I'm obviously...
it's working.
I've prepared well.
Right, because if you were waiting till next week, it would be over already.
Oh, darn the luck.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I suppose we should take a break here.
I guess. I got more news, but
okay.
We can take a break.
Well, we're going to get to that right after this, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
So, I'm a dog, and I just got adopted by this new human guy, and I'm starting to wonder how he got along without me. I mean, okay, something as simple as walking around the block. He's got this leash thing, and he puts me on one end and him on the other, and I'm just taking him around. I think he's afraid of getting lost. Without that leash and me guiding him along, I don't think he'd find his way back home, but it's kind of cute.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm Greg Pretty.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we've got just a short bit of news here for you before we dive into our second set of guests for this hour.
We do indeed. NABS has some competition, it seems.
Really?
Yeah, the North American Handmade Bike Show, which comes up in February 22nd through 24th, is going to have some competition in the form of Rene Urst Bicycles and Boulder Bikes. They've rented a space at the Denver Marriott City Hotel because they, quote, had too much stuff to show. Now, I'm not sure what that's all about, but they invited three artists and builders to join them, Bruce Gordon, Mark Nobilette, and Mark DiNucci, who won Best Lug Frame at NABS in 2010 and Best in Show at 2011. So I'm not sure why they've done it. It's only a four-hour period on the 24th from 4 to 8 p.m., and they'll be close to the convention center. It's a statement, and I'm not sure, you know, maybe it's space. I don't know.
It is a little odd.
I thought I would just, you know, put it out there that there will be this sort of, not really a competing show because it's only for 4 hours and NABS goes for 2 days, or 3 days, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. But it will sort of overlap that last day a little bit. So we'll see.
Okay.
All right. My last item is from the Streets Blog Network. And on January 31st, they talked about a study of people who bike or walk to work enjoy their commutes the most, by Angie Schmidt. Now, I'm not sure how they come to this conclusion, and I'm not really good with graphs about, you know, this is the commute well-being scale over the commute mode, beginning with cars and going to local bus, carpool, light rail, express, walk, bicycle. But a study by PhD candidate Oliver Smith at Portland State University found that of all types of commuters, those who travel by bike rank the highest on measures of well-being. This news will surprise no one who has discovered the joy that is setting off to work on two wheels, but new research out of Portland State University found that people who bike to work enjoy their commutes the most. People who walk to work are close behind on the commute satisfaction scale. The finding is based on a survey of commuters from the region conducted by PhD candidate Oliver Smith, Jonathan Mouse, at network blog Bike Portland heard about the study at a happy hour transportation geek out put on by the Portland State University's Urban Planning School, where students shared research they had recently presented at the Transportation Research Board in D.C. So we know that people tell us and have for many years that their sanity comes from riding their bikes. So I can believe that they have more well-being riding their bikes than driving their cars. And that's my news this week.
Makes sense.
It does. It does indeed.
The more I read about this climate change and the more it just – it seems inevitable, and it pains me to say this because I don't have the luxury of commuting or by bike or walking. But I think the way we're doing things now is truly not sustainable over the long term, no matter how many technological advances we make in terms of renewable energy. We're still down to that conservation of mass and energy. It takes energy to make energy.
True.
And so somewhere along the line, we got to figure out how to get ourselves around in a more efficient manner.
Well, it would be nice to see a little more emphasis on things like light rail and good public transit in cities. You know, like we were in Geauga County for a long time, and there was nothing. There are no sidewalks. There are no good roads. It's hard to ride. It's hard to take the bus.
Even with all that infrastructure, we are too damn spread out.
So you're saying we all need to live back in the cities.
There has to be density.
I don't disagree. I think Brian would disagree. He likes the wide open, you know.
You can visit that stuff.
You can visit that stuff. They're called parks.
Well, and how many times do you go to work a week? Probably five. How many times do you go to the park every week?
Seldom.
Less than one.
Usually.
So which trip does it make more sense to have be the longer trip?
True that.
I'm the worst offender, but at least I think I'm recognizing a trend here. And there's a day coming and we're all going to be hurting.
Ow, ow, ow.
We are.
No, I agree. I agree. I can't disagree with that. You know.
But maybe those endorphins will balance out the pain of not being able to just hop in our cars and go 30 miles at the click of a switch.
I'm waiting for the day when I say, here are my keys.
Yeah.
And so the answer is either you're going to cart my butt around or I'm going to have to either walk or take public transit or ride a bike. And yeah. I'm going to be hopefully in a place where I can do all those things.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, that was sort of an unintentional segue into the guys we're going to talk to next.
No kidding. You're right. Yes, we are. We're going to talk to a couple of professors, one by the name of John Pooker, who is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's actually on sabbatical right now. And the other is Professor Ralph Bueller, who is in Alexandria, Virginia. They have written a new book called City Cycling. Actually, they've edited a new book called City Cycling, compiled from a lot of really interesting research and by a lot of very smart and very focused people on cycling. So let's welcome Ralph Bueller and John Pooker to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening, gentlemen. I'd like each of you to introduce yourself.
I'm John Pooker. I'm a professor of urban planning and transportation at Rutgers University in New Jersey, but currently I'm on sabbatical at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and I do research on cycling and walking and public transit as the most sustainable means of transportation, and I do an international comparative perspective, so looking really across the globe.
And Ralph?
I'm Ralph Bueller. I'm an assistant professor in urban affairs and planning at Virginia Tech in Alexandria, Virginia. And as my accent may tell you, I'm originally from Germany and not from Virginia. And as John, most of my research has an international comparative perspective, looking at transport and land use policies, transport systems, and determinants of how people get around in mainly Western Europe and North America.
We'd just like to add one thing for your audience. I was born in downtown Cleveland at University Hospital, and I took my first bike rides on Parkside Boulevard in South Euclid. That's where I grew up. So.
And as many of our listeners who hear this show know, we are in Northeast Ohio, in the Cleveland area. We are only about 6 minutes away from South Euclid, which is where I happen to live. But I know there are listeners worldwide, too. So very, very nice. And you and I have had that kind of conversation over the Internet, John. So it's really good to actually talk with you. So, gentlemen, you have a new book from MIT Press called City Cycling, and it is a very comprehensive book. I don't know who wants to answer this question, but for whom did you actually write this book?
Well, we wrote it for a lot of different people. We didn't want to just have it for academics. We really wanted to have it for cyclists, so actually people who are out there riding a bike. We wanted to have it for the average person who maybe occasionally gets on a bike, as well as for the avid cyclist. We wanted it to be for city planners, for transportation planners, so people who can actually use this information to improve conditions for cyclists. We intended it also for public health experts, because there's two entire chapters really devoted to the issue of health and safety benefits, health benefits of cycling and making cycling safer. And Ralph can probably add some more groups that we were intending. Ralph?
Yes, it can be policymakers, planners, engineers, but also those who do not cycle, who may not even consider cycling as a mode of transport and hadn't thought about it. Read the book and it may get you on a bike.
That's even a better idea, getting more people involved in cycling. So there are a lot of distinguished people who contributed different chapters to the book. And it seems like their fields of research range anywhere from public health and urban planning and sustainability to engineering, housing, and mathematics. How long did it take to actually put this book together?
Forever. I think it was 3.5 or 4 years. It took a very long time.
I think it was about 4 years. I think in the late fall of 2008, we talked about it for the first time, and it took till 2012 for the book to be in print.
So let's take an overview of the book. Ralph, tell me some of the topics that you worked on. I know several of the chapters you two wrote yourselves, but how did you come to choose the chapters? And tell us a little bit about some of the chapters that were most interesting to you.
Our goal was to sort of give a comprehensive overview of different aspects of cycling. And so we chose authors for different chapters covering these aspects. So we were, of course, interested in the infrastructure of bicycling, or the bike lanes, bike paths, so on and so forth. The bicycle itself, there's a chapter in there on bicycle technology and how bicycle developed, but of course also about the benefits of bicycling and the speed of cycling, the health benefits of bicycling, who the bicyclists are. So we have chapters on different groups of cyclists, women and children, for example. And we also looked at different size cities. We have a chapter on small cities, on medium cities, and on mega cities. And for all of these chapters, we try to look internationally, so across different countries and also across different disciplines, to bring a sort of a holistic, comprehensive perspective on the chapters.
One of the topics of particular interest to me is the chapter on effective speed. So the claim is that cycling is faster than other forms of transportation. John, can you explain that? I thought it was fascinating.
Well, it's that we spend, that most people who own cars spend a lot of money buying the car, paying off car payments, paying for gasoline, paying for parking, paying for repairs to your car, and it's an enormous expense. And it turns out that the average American spends 2 months a year working just to finance their cars. So to sort of tell you why that's relevant, what the this concept of effective speed says is, when you consider all of the time you spend earning the money to be able to finance your car, to buy it, to operate it, to park it, and so forth, it turns out that then cycling, because it's so much cheaper, is actually saving you a lot of time. Certainly the average cyclist is not spending 2 months of every year as a slave to the automobile, really working exclusively to finance the car. And so this notion of effective speed is saying, when you take into account Also, the time that you're spending to finance the car, then it turns out that cycling is in most instances faster than driving the car, and that most motorists don't even think of that. They don't realize that they are enslaving themselves to their car for 2 months of the year just to pay off the car.
Such an interesting concept. People don't even look at that. And I read that chapter and I said, wow, that's really probably true. I can understand how that came about. So I know a lot of our listeners are aware of all the new equipment that's come on the market. I mean, everybody talks about equipment, and there's a big increase in the urban use of bicycles. Ralph, is there anything that especially stood out for you in the chapter on equipment when you were editing the book?
I think what stood out for me in the chapter, but also in my experience coming from Europe to the U.S. and North America, is that we see more and more bikes here that are utilitarian bikes. So we have fenders, we have lights, we have a rack to transport things, we have protected chains that you don't get dirty. So we are seeing more and more utilitarian bikes making it into the mainstream here in North America. When I got here first in the early 2000s, and in 2000 actually, it was very hard to find a bike that had pre-installed fenders, lights, and a protected chain, and not to mention a bike where you actually sit back and are not hunched over like speeding or mountain biking. So I think that's what's standing out, is that the bike is getting more and more comfortable for different people and for different uses. It's going away from just being a sports machine to being a mode of daily, a tool for daily transport.
So I would just add one thing. The thing that also stood out for me is the incredible range of bikes that are available, the incredible range of equipment, now there are the accessories, that go with the bike, and the incredible range of clothing that now is available for people who are sort of serious cyclists. So there's just a huge market out there now that's developed for bikes, for bike accessories, and also for bike clothing.
One more point here. I think the bicycle itself and the bike equipment have become quite fashionable and trendy. You see more and more bicycles now featured in clothes magazines and in movies. So the bicycle and bike culture has become the hip thing.
Which is a good thing. We like that. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners who are speaking with Professors John Pooker and Ralph Bueller. They've written a new book called City Cycling, and that's what we're talking about this evening. So one of the things we talk about a lot on this show, and I think a lot of people are interested in it, are the health benefits of cycling, especially for children. We have a huge problem with things like obesity and diabetes in children. And I think that part of the reason children aren't riding as much as they did maybe 30 years ago is the safety factor. So can you address how you weigh the benefits against the risks and then convince parents to allow their children to ride their bikes or even walk?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. First of all, I would just note that there is a chapter in the book, two of the chapters, that compare the traffic risks, in terms of health risks, the traffic dangers of cycling, whatever they might be, with the health benefits of cycling because of all the cardiovascular exercise and so forth and so on. And every single study, and there are dozens of them now, show that the health benefits of cycling far, far, far outweigh whatever the traffic dangers are. That's not to say that there aren't any dangers of cycling, and it's certainly not to say that it shouldn't be made safer. We certainly want to make it as safe as possible. But even at the current situation, which is less than perfect, what all of these public health studies show is the health benefits of cycling, in terms of the cardiovascular benefits and so forth, they outweigh the traffic dangers. It's something like a ratio of 10 to 1, 6 to 1, 20 to 1. It depends on the city, it depends on the country. But yes, even in the United States, where cycling is less than perfectly safe, that the health benefits far, far outweigh the traffic dangers. In terms of kids in particular, I think there's two really, really important things to consider. That obesity, diabetes, have been increasing the fastest among American children. There's been a quadrupling in obesity among American children over the past 30 years. And I think one of the reasons is parents are afraid to let their kids out of the house at all, let alone walk or bike to school. And part of the problem is, I think there really is an exaggerated perception among parents about not only stranger danger, but also traffic dangers of kids walking or biking to school. And in fact, in many states, in some cities, in some school districts, there are even prohibitions prohibiting kids from walking or biking to school. And I think the problem is one of perception. And that is, when one child is abducted or when one child is seriously injured in a traffic, walking or biking to school, it makes the headlines immediately. And so parents panic, and they said, no, I'm not going to let my kid out of the house. I'm going to chauffeur them door-to-door to the school. What parents don't realize is it's 1,000 times more likely that their kid is going to have serious health problems because the kids are being chauffeured to school, and they're going to have diabetes, stroke, heart problems, and whatever, all of these problems that result from a lack of physical activity. And so I wish that parents could somehow realistically look at the evidence, look at the research, which all shows that children don't get enough physical activity, and one really, really logical, easy, and inexpensive way of getting kids more physical activity is letting them walk or bike to school, and it also then frees up the parents from having to drive the kid back and forth to school. We have walking school buses. We have bicycling school buses. So you have parents taking turns walking with the kids to school or biking with the kids to school. So that sort of gets around the sort of stranger danger issue, but it also then protects the kids in terms of guiding them through the traffic so that they're safe. So I really think parents are doing their kids a huge disservice by preventing them from walking and biking to school and by really robbing their children of the mobility, the independence, and the physical activity they would get by walking or biking to school.
In both in stranger danger and also in the traffic safety aspect, there is safety in numbers. So the more children that are walking or cycling to school and the more parents that are also with children walking or cycling to school, the safer it will get per kilometer walked or per mile walked, per mile cycled. And also the stranger danger is reduced because there are more eyes on the street. So it's beneficial for everyone to have more children cycle and walk to school. And the second point is one that John just alluded to, is this sense of self-efficacy that children can actually get to school under their own power. They don't have to rely on their parents to get places. That sort of frees them, or they're not that dependent on their parents to explore their own environment. And that's also a benefit for the children.
Yeah, I would just like to add one thing in terms of the health benefits of cycling, because I think it's absolutely crucial. Some people will say, oh, you're wasting your time cycling. This gets back in a way to the effect of speed, but it goes beyond it. It's more than just the finances. There was a study done showing that for every hour you spend walking or cycling, you add more than an hour to your healthy lifetime. That is, a lifetime without any serious disabilities. Let me just repeat that. For every hour you spend walking or cycling, you add more than an hour to your expected healthy lifetime. So anyone that tells you you're wasting your time walking or biking is crazy. You are actually extending your expected healthy lifetime by walking and cycling.
And I absolutely can believe that that's true. So, Ralph, I have a question, because you come from Europe, and Europe is much more bicycle friendly. And there in the book, you're talking about increasing the number of women who ride their bikes. And the conclusion was that bicycle-friendly countries have a much higher percentage of women who ride. So what makes countries such as the Netherlands eager to encourage cycling when the U.S. almost seems to do the opposite?
First, I want to say it's not all of Europe that is bicycle-friendly. So it's
okay.
Not just being in Europe and suddenly you get on a bike and it's bike-friendly and it's great. There are certain countries like Denmark, the Netherlands, and to some extent also Germany that really have put in place policies to promote cycling and to promote cycling for all groups, including women, especially by providing different types of facilities for cyclists. So here in the U.S., most cycling is in the street with cars, and there are only certain people who are willing to do that. And if we look at the statistics, these are typically younger men that are more risk takers, and they like to cycle in the street with cars. But if you want to enlarge the group of people who can't possibly cycle, you have to build facilities for those who are more risk averse. They can also be younger men that are more risk averse, but in most surveys, women, but also older individuals, tend to be more risk averse, and they prefer having separate facilities. And countries such as the Netherlands, but also Denmark, and to some extent Germany, have in their cities built bike facilities networks where you can ride on a bike lane or a separate bike path or even a cycle track that gives you some protection in the street from any origin to any destination in the city without ever really sharing the street with automobiles. And that attracts more people. And here in the U.S., most cities do not have real networks of bike facilities if they have bike facilities at all. And so I think that's one big part of what's behind the higher share of the population cycling in Europe.
I think there's something to add to that, and that is a feeling of comfort. And that is, it's not just actual safety, but really a feeling of safety, a feeling of comfort in stress-free cycling. And almost everyone, really, there are exceptions to this, maybe racing cyclists and so forth, but most people surveyed, I would say 80, 90%, prefer these physically protected bikeways. They can be on street, but physically protected from moving vehicle traffic or off-street bike paths. And when women are surveyed, or even if you observe how different kinds of people choose their routes, women, as well as seniors and children, or the parents of children, will almost always choose the route that is not just on the street. It's protected in some way from the motor vehicle traffic. And I think that's one of the keys. I'd just like also to add, in terms of this chapter on women, we didn't write it. three women who were the leading specialists on women and cycling wrote that chapter. And they find that women are really an indicator species. That is, if you want to determine whether or not a city's bicycling policies are successful, you can forget all the fancy mathematics, forget all the equations and so forth. Look, just count the percentage of bicyclists out there who are women. And if you've got a 50-50 mix, and that is the case, by the way, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, in all of Scandinavia, in Germany, in the Switzerland, in Austria, it's 50-50. You've got as many women cycling as you have men cycling, and their conclusion is whatever they're doing, I mean, we can describe later what they are doing, that's the right thing to do because you have as many women cycling as you have men cycling, whereas in the United States, you have about three times as many men cycling as you have women cycling. And so I really like it was the most insightful chapter for me personally because we didn't write it. And so I'm not surprising that was the one where you have the most unusual things coming up that you weren't expecting. But I thought it was really interesting their identification of women as being the indicator species of the success of cycling.
So, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this up. So I have one more really, really interesting question, I think. Were there any surprises, and did you come to any conclusions when you were finished with all of these chapters and putting the book together? And then we're going to let our listeners know how to get a copy of the book, because it's really an interesting and in-depth book.
I can tell you what my big surprise was,
what?
And that is, I would never have imagined this, that bicycling was viewed as the number one form of women's emancipation at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. I would never, ever have guessed it.
That's
it's
true.
Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who were the two leading feminists way back when, I mean, over 100 years ago, they actually said nothing made them happier or prouder to be a woman as when they saw a woman on a bicycle, that it was a form of independence for women, mobility for women, and it helped give them independence from men. That surprised me. That was the one thing that surprised me the most in the entire book.
And Ralph, how about you?
I'm not sure if there was one big surprise. I think the main surprise was that there's so much interest and so much research on bicycling and that we were able to get people, experts really, from different disciplines and different backgrounds and different parts of the world all together to collaborate on this book. And even though it took 4 years, it went quite smoothly and we got we got great chapters in it. So I was quite pleased in the end that all of this came together so nicely.
So how can people get a copy of City Cycling?
Okay. The book is available via all online booksellers. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, there are many other online bookstores as well. It's available in bookstores, but probably the easiest way for most listeners is to get it online. You can also order it directly from MIT Press.
Well, John Pucher, Ralph Buehler, City Cycling, thank you so much for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening. I really enjoyed the book. It's very comprehensive. I will go back to it probably again and again because I didn't really understand every single thing that you said then, but I understand a lot of it now. So I recommend it. It's a good book. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. By the way, I really like the title of this show because I consider myself also a very outspoken cyclist.
You can thank Greg for that. That was his idea, and I agree. Everybody likes it. Thank you so much. I have a lot of success with your book.
Thanks.
All right. Good night.
Night.
John Pucher joined us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Ralph Buehler was in Alexandria, Virginia, and they have co-edited a new book called City Cycling.
Very interesting book. You can't really read it cover to cover because it's about research, and there are a lot of charts and there's a lot of data in here, but it's got really interesting chapters. I like that one about effective speed. It made a lot of sense to me. So some nice topics, and I think everybody could find something that they would like in this book.
I was doing the math during that interview, and I figured out that I've added more than 12 days to my productive lifespan this year.
Wow.
So you take your annual mileage.
Yeah.
Divide by the speed you typically ride at. So it doesn't have to be exact, but you know about how fast you average.
Okay.
And that gives you the number of hours you spent on the bike.
And then
divide by 24.
Okay.
And you get the number of days.
And you got 12.
So, you know, do the math if you're inclined, and you can see, you know, just how much you're extending your useful, as they said, disability-free life by being on a bike. It might surprise you. What surprised me is that Radiothon is upon us.
It is.
It sneaks up on us, and we think about it coming, and then before we know it, there it is. It's staring us in the face. So it's the next two Saturdays, and you will have the pleasure of hearing us talk about Radiothon a lot in the next couple of weeks. But then it'll be all over for another year, and you won't have to listen to us hound you to send us money to support WJCU.
That's correct.
So
once a year, whether you like it or not.
Just keep that in mind. Roll it around in your head. I know cyclists are cheap, but...
No, we want to win. I want to win.
It's a fact. Cyclists are some of the cheapest people I know.
Oh, I don't know.
But
I'm so glad you're saying this and not me.
Really? Well, anyway, if you'd like to prove us wrong about the frugality of cyclists, send us money next week when we ask for it, or the following week during Radiothon 2013 at WJCU.
We'll see you next week.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.